The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Morning, Glory America. Bonjour. Hi, Kennedy, Hugh Hewitt, Nashville, where the Republican Governors Association continues its meeting. We had a great day yesterday. We got many of the governors coming by this morning after they wake up. I'm a little early for the governors. They just don't like to rise at 5 o'clock in the morning, Tennessee time, but they'll be here at 6 o'clock in the morning. In the meantime, I'm going to depart from the rundown a little bit because of an extraordinary pair of hearings that happened yesterday. In the first, David Chapman, President Biden's radical nominee to head the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Agency, and then Dr. Fauci. Let's begin with David Chapman under questioning from Senator Tom Cotton yesterday, cut number 18.
You have called for an assault weapons ban. I have a simple question for you. What is an assault weapon?
Senator, an assault weapon would be, in the context of the question you asked, what Congress defines it as.
So you're asking us to ban assault weapons. We have to write legislation. Can you tell me what is an assault weapon? How would you define it if you were the head of the ATF? How have you defined it over the last several years as your role as a gun control advocate?
Senator, if I'm confirmed as ATF director, my recollection is the only process by which ATF is weighed in is that I know there's a demand letter 3 program, which requires multiple reports, multiple sale reports on the southwestern border. And ATF in that program has defined an assault rifle as any semi-automatic rifle capable of accepting a detachable magazine above the caliber of .22, which would include a .223, which is, largely the AR-15 round.
So you believe that every weapon that takes a detachable magazine that can take a 22 round or 5.56 in military parlance should be defined as an assault weapon?
Let me clarify. What I believe I just said is any semi-automatic rifle.
Any semi-automatic rifle.
What?
That's the definite. A detachable magazine that takes a 5.56 or 22 round should be defined as an assault weapon.
Senator, you asked me if ATF had used this term. And I was sharing with you my knowledge of a program in which ATF has defined this term. And it is in the Demand Letter 3 program. And that rifle is a semi-automatic rifle capable of accepting a detachable magazine with a round greater than a .22 caliber. And in those cases, firearms dealers on the southwest border are required to make a multiple sale report to ATF.
I'm amazed that might be the definition of assault weapon. That would basically cover every single modern sporting rifle in America today. Let me put it this way. If I wanted to buy an assault weapon and I walked into Walmart or Cabela's or some other firearm dealers and I looked up on the wall where they were labeling their weapons, would there be a label on the wall for assault weapon?
I don't believe, Senator, and thank you for this question, that the firearms industry has used the term assault rifle in their marketing since there was a ban on it. It was after that they changed their use of the term assault rifle to the modern sporting rifle.
Well, so I've been in Walmarts and I've been in Cabela's, and I've seen that you can find sections for pistols or handguns or for shotguns or for rifles because those are actual kinds of firearms. I think our exchange here illustrates that there really is no such thing as an assault weapon. That is a term that was manufactured by liberal lawyers and pollsters in Washington to try to scare the American people into believing that the government should confiscate weapons that are wildly popular for millions of Americans to defend themselves and their families and their homes.
I think Senator Joe Manchin had just better bring his in. He just had better bring it in because this radical David Chapman wants his gun. Now, this kept up. Our friend Marsha Blackburn, who was on the show Friday,
had the next conversation with him, cut number 17.
In that hearing, I was commenting on the fact that I had the opportunity to enforce the National Firearms Act for 24 years. That was an act that balanced the right of individuals to possess those firearms, but had a regulatory structure that I found kept them out of the hands of criminals, which is the ultimate goal of all Americans. I thought, and I expressed that belief at that time, that the National Firearms Act would be a proper way to balance the rights and responsibilities.
So the National Firearms Act would be enough?
I believe that the National Firearms Act would be enough.
Let me.
It's yes, he's in favor of that, and it's remarkable. Let me finish this bit with Senator Ted Cruz, then weighed in with David Chapman, Joe Biden's radical nominee to run the gun regulation agency, ATF. Cut 19.
With respect to the AR-15, I support a ban as has been presented in a Senate bill. And supported by the president. The AR-15 is a gun I was issued on ATF's SWAT team, and it's a particularly lethal weapon, and regulating it as other particularly lethal weapons I have advocated for. As ATF director, if I'm confirmed, I would simply enforce the laws on the books, and right now there is no such ban on those guns.
So you want to ban the most popular rifle in America? A minute ago, and you noted there is a Senate bill. Senator Feinstein had a bill to ban some 2,000 specified rifles and other firearms in her bill. In 2013, the Democrats had a majority in the Senate. It was the Harry Reid Senate. And we voted on the Senate floor on Senator Feinstein's so-called assault weapon ban. Do you know how many senators voted for it?
No, I do not.
40. 60 voted against it. So in a Democratic Senate, a supermajority voted against a ban. Now, part of the reason they voted against the ban, as you're aware, is during the Clinton administration, there was a ban in effect. The Department of Justice studied the effect of that law and discovered that it had no measurable impact on violent crime. Is that right?
Senator, I did enforce this law for 10 years as an ATF agent. I'm unfamiliar with the study that you are pointing out, and I apologize for that.
Well, when you and I met in my office last night and discussed it, I asked if there are any data to suggest that the ban was effective. And what you said in the office is you were not aware of any data, that the data was, I think, mixed is the term you used.
Yes, Senator. What I said to you yesterday, you've accurately stated it. I think it was mixed, which, you know, I stand by that remark, and I think my recollection is that evidence was shown that the limitation on magazine size had an impact. I also believe that later studies showed that the use of assault weapons in mass shootings had declined during that period. But that's how I would like to characterize my views on that.
So you also said when you and I talked yesterday in the office that Senator Feinstein's bill, which a supermajority of senators voted against in a Democratic Senate, you said that bill didn't go far enough and you wanted an even broader ban to ban. You said it didn't go far enough. Is that right?
Senator, thanks for that question and the ability to clarify. What I did say is that Senator Feinstein's bill did not address those firearms that are currently in the possession of Americans. And then I did share with you my view as an advocate, which would be quite different than someone actually enforcing the law in the books, that those firearms could be treated under the NFA and regulated that way, which would deal with those currently in the possession of Americans.
Yeah, I believe he worked for Mark Kelly's organization. I believe Senator Kelly employed this radical, and Arizona should be aware of that. But more importantly, you should be aware of that. Now, I'm not a gun guy, though my brother-in-law, George, has promised that by the end of the summer I will be proficient with a shotgun. That's a very dangerous thing, given my eye-hand coordination, but we're going to try. Nevertheless, I don't know anything about guns, but I know a radical when I hear one. He's going to come and get your guns, but I don't think Bernie Sanders is going to want to bring his guns in. And Joe Manchin, they got to bring their guns in with this guy, so they might as well just bring him to the Senate and turn him over to him because, unloaded, of course, because that is... He wants them. He's going to get them. Hey, let me tell you, we've got more. We got so much audio today from the Senate yesterday. Don't go anywhere. That's an unusual rundown for me. Other stuff happened in the world, but that hearing, there are a lot of people who own guns in the United States, and the ATF nominee wants them all. And you ought to tell your senator whether or not you want that individual, David Chapman, to be confirmed. Don't go anywhere. You can go over to Twitter and find the guests who are ahead at Hugh Hewitt. You can go to my Facebook page. Of course, you can hear the rundown every single day at the Hugh Hewitt Show on podcast, Highly Concentrated View. We use this segment, the rundown, plus key interviews. That's every day at the Hugh Hewitt Show podcast, everywhere that podcasts are available. Stay with us. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. I want to tell you, I greatly respect Dr. Tony Fauci and Dr. Francis Collins. Greatly respect them. They've both been guests. They are both invited back. In March of this year, I asked Dr. Fauci about gain-of-function research in Wuhan. That answer is over at Twitter. No, we don't. Did they? I asked if the NIH supported gain-of-function research in Wuhan, and the answer is no, I don't. We didn't, not now, not ever, never. And I asked Dr. Collins that few weeks ago, and he said, I don't think we've ever done that. That's too dangerous. Yesterday, Dr. Fauci appeared before the Senate and on that subject, and the first person he talks to, I believe, is Ted Cruz, cut number 11.
We had a big scare with SARS-CoV-1 back in 2002, 2003, where that particular virus unquestionably went from a bat to an intermediate host to start an epidemic and a pandemic that resulted in 8,000 cases and close to 800 deaths. It would have been almost a dereliction of our duty if we didn't study this. And the only way you can study these things is you've got to go where the action is. So I often say, somewhat tongue in cheek, you don't want to study bats in Fairfax County, Virginia, to find out what the animal-human interface is that might lead to a jumping of species. So we had a modest collaboration with very respectable Chinese scientists who are world experts on coronavirus. And we did that through a sub-grant from a larger grant to EcoHealth. The sub-grant was about $600,000 over a period of 5 years. So it was a modest amount. And the purpose of it was to study the animal-human interface, to do surveillance, and to determine if these bat viruses were even capable of transing infection to humans.
Now, that is not what he told me. And, I mean, it was pretty adamant, and Dr. Collins was also pretty adamant. He went on to discuss this with Senator John Kenney of Louisiana. Cut 13.
Dr. Fauci, I believe you have testified that you didn't give any money to the Wuhan lab to conduct gain-of-function research. Is that right?
That is correct.
How do you know they didn't lie to you?
Excuse me, sir?
How do you know they didn't lie to you and use the money for gain-of-function research anyway?
Well, we've seen the results of the experiments that were done and that were published, and that the viruses that they studied are on public databases now. So none of that was gain-of-function. So
how do you know they didn't do the research and not put it on their website?
There's no way of guaranteeing that, but in our experience with grantees, including Chinese grantees, which we've had interactions with for a very long period of time, they're very competent, trustworthy scientists. I'm not talking about anything else in China. I'm talking about the scientists, that you would expect that they would abide by the conditions of the grant, which they've done for the years that we've had interactions.
So you don't think the Chinese would lie to you?
Well, when you say the Chinese are a rather broad group. I know the scientists that we've dealt with have been trustworthy.
Mm-hmm. You think all the scientists have told the truth in terms of the origin of the Wuhan virus and not been influenced by the Communist Party of China, do you?
I don't have enough insight into the Communist Party in China to know the interactions between them and the scientists, sir.
Right.
Now, he continued the conversation, cut number with John Kennedy, cut number 14.
Why are we giving him money in the first place?
Well, that's a very good question, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to answer it. Well, SARS-CoV-1 started in China, in Guangdong province, and it went from a bat to a civet cat to a human.
Yes, and excuse me, Doc, for interrupting you, but our time is so
limited. No, I'm going to be real quick.
Our time is so limited. Why are we giving money to the labs in China to study virology?
Well, I'm going to give you a rather succinct answer to that, sir.
I appreciate that.
And that's why I was saying the SARS-CoV-1, clearly the bats that have the viruses, that are the coronaviruses, are in China. As I said a couple of times, it's not in Fairfax County, Virginia, or is it in New York? It's in China. So if you want to show and study, importantly, the animal-human interface.
Because that's where the bats are.
Yeah, the bats. Okay. That's where the bats are.
I want to be sure I understand your testimony. You didn't give money to the Wuhan lab to do gain-of-function research.
That is correct.
And you believe they didn't do gain-of-function research because they told you they didn't.
We've seen the results of the studies that they conducted. And they were not
including any private studies.
Excuse me? Including
any private studies.
I'm not sure what you're getting at, sir.
Here's what I'm getting at. You gave them money and you said, don't do gain of function research.
Correct.
And they said, we won't.
Correct.
And you have no way of knowing whether they did or not, except you trust them. Is that right?
Well, we generally always trust the grantee to do what they say, and you look at the results.
Have you ever had a grantee lie to you?
I cannot guarantee that a grantee has not lied to us, because you never know.
Yeah. Oh, boy. One more. Cut number 15, Dr. Fauci with Marco Rubio.
I have always said that the high likelihood is that this is a natural occurrence. I didn't dismiss anything. I just said it's a high likelihood that this is a natural occurrence from the environment of an animal reservoir that we have not yet identified. Well, and I still maintain that. But as I just mentioned in response to other questions, that since you don't know 100% about that, because no one knows, including me, 100% what the origin is the reason why we're in favor of further investigation.
The most powerful words in the English language, the three most powerful words in the English language. I've often said they're the eight most, to young audience, I tell young audiences the eight most powerful words in the English language are, I know a guy, and have you ever considered? Because that's someone giving you an opportunity. If you're under the age of 30 and someone says to you, I know a guy, or I know a gal, or they say to you, have you ever considered, they're about to suggest that you go see someone or do something that may be outside of your purview, and they're about to give you a connection. They're about to do you a favor. But everybody in the world, all age groups, all sexes, all people in all times, the three most important words in the English language are, I don't know. You see, if you answer, I don't know, you're just admitting ignorance on a particular sub, which ignorance can always be cured. You can learn, and I don't know usually leads to tell me about it. And I learned this the hard way. It takes 30 years of broadcast. If Dr. Fauci had told me in March, I don't know, I wouldn't have a clip of him saying, no, we didn't do that. If Dr. Collins had told me, I don't know, we wouldn't have audio of him saying that. If Dr. Fauci would just simply have told the Senate, I don't know, they're lying Chinese sons of, you know, I don't know. They're communists, Chinese communist SOBs. Of course, you can trust Chinese scientists in the United States. You can trust Chinese American scientists in the United States. You cannot trust communist scientists anywhere. And I want to repeat that. You cannot trust communist scientists anywhere. Why? Because their governments will shoot them if they do something wrong. Remember what the Chinese communist scientist said? The brave one stood up and put the DNA code of the virus on the web, and he got disappeared. That's what happens to Chinese communist scientists when they tell the truth. So really, I don't know. The CDC's credibility is in tatters. And I want Dr. Fauci and Dr. Collins to come back because they're both good guys. I like them a lot. They've been good guests. They're very reassuring on matters with which they are familiar. But I'm here to tell you, I know more about communist regimes than either of them do or both of them combined. They have spent their lives in science, and I have spent my lives in politics. And I began with Richard Nixon, and you know, also people like Stanley Hoffman and Harvey Mansfield studying communist ideology and the regimes that have iterated therefrom. So I know these people. I know their regimes. And it doesn't matter if they're Russian scientists or Chinese scientists or North Korean scientists or Cuban scientists, they will lie to you. And so the idea that now they should have known that we were giving money to Wuhan, that is simply they didn't know and they were very adamant that we hadn't. And now they're wrong and their credibility suffers. And now they have to say, you know, I've been very wrong. I've been very wrong. That's another powerful set of words. I was wrong. Remember Fonzie saying that on Happy Days, if you're old enough or you watch the reruns? I was... Dwayne has that problem. I was... And I don't have that problem, but I'm never wrong. Dwayne has that problem. And this is a problem that is not unique to me or to Dwayne or to Dr. Fauci and Dr. Collins. But just remember, I don't know. I don't know.
I don't know. I don't know.
Dwayne, say, I don't know.
I don't know.
I don't know. That's another way of saying I don't know. Adam, can you say I don't know? I don't know. Is Harley or Ben there today?
Well, I don't know. Everybody knows they don't know.
Everybody knows. Which one is there?
They both are.
Oh, let's get their renditions of I don't know.
I don't know.
Harley?
I don't know.
Man, see, if I had a nickel for every time I heard that.
Yeah, I mean, these guys are interns. They don't know anything. And so I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. My gosh. Take that one to the bank, America. Take that one to the bank. Take this to the bank as well. ReliefFactor.com. About to talk with Alfredo Ortiz about another great sponsor of this show, Job Creators Network. Go join JCN.com. But here are my four... Karen Kirkman, Resveratrol, Omega. I saw Pat Boone on TV last night playing tennis and taking this. I hate tennis. But I love Pat Boone, and Pat Boone was taking his Relief Factor, but he didn't take it on film. These guys, I don't know why they ever do that. All I have to do is take it, and you get lukewarm coffee, have some Gatorade, whatever it is, and just take it. Joe Piscopo on TV and Pat Boone. I don't do TV commercials, but I do take Relief Factor every day. Why? I had to walk 20 miles yesterday with Dwayne trying to find a restaurant. He took us in the wrong direction in Nashville.
Gee, I don't know. That doesn't sound right to me.
And, well, it was close to 20 miles. And I told him it was going to rain, and it rained on us, and he ignored that. And it was a bad day in Nashville yesterday when we went to lunch. And Alfredo will testify. He saw us going to lunch, and I was shaking my head. It's going to rain. And we walked away, and we got wet. But I was able to walk that distance because of ReliefFactor.com. Don't forget to go and get it, $19.95, America, ReliefFactor.com. I'll be right back with Alfredo Ortiz of Job Creators Network next on The Hugh Hewitt Show. And I've been taking care of business every day, taking care of business. Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt in Nashville, where the governors are assembled. I'm wandering around the lobby yesterday, and I run into Alfredo Ortiz, Job Creators Network's president. And I remember, join JCN.com if you want to become a part of a national movement. Join JCN.com. Alfredo is here working the governors. And Alfredo, good to see you. Thank you for getting up early in
Absolutely.
Nashville.
Thank you.
Tell us what you've gotten done here, what you've heard, and what you think the governors are up to.
Well, first of all, I mean, they're all fantastic. Our Republican governors, thank goodness they're around, because from Doug Ducey out in Arizona all the way down to Governor DeSantis down in Florida, it has been fantastic what they've done. You see the results. They were on Hannity last night, six of our governors, talking about the impact that they've had in their states. And it's tremendous, right? And it's really lower taxes, less red tape, less regulation, and freedom. Especially actually on schools. And this is one thing that, you know, we really have to make hay in terms of what Biden has done here or not done, which has shown zero leadership when it comes to school openings. He has completely left that to the teachers' unions. And it's a shame, because in the red states where the governors acted specifically on that, schools are doing great. people are doing great. The teachers are happy. The parents are happy. The kids are happy. The economies are booming. You hear some of the unemployment rates, for example, from some of the governors in the Dakotas, stuff like that. It's amazing. 2%, 2.5% rates.
Arizona's back to where they were. They're now bonusing people to go back to work.
Yeah, that's right.
So I went yesterday to the panel. And again, I tell everyone, you're a sponsor of my show. You're one of my four favorite sponsors because your ideals align with exactly what I want to get done. And Governor Dunleavy of Alaska, big Governor Dunleavy, and the Governor of Wyoming, Idaho, and Doug Ducey, about what the Biden administration has done to jobs in those states. They've taken aside the job by putting a moratorium on federal lands. They are breaking the word. They are unemploying people by the tens of thousands get swept away.
Yeah, that's right.
These guys need messaging amplification, which is Job Creators Network's job.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, I think that is one of our key things that we help do is on the messaging front, creating that echo chamber that's so desperately needed. In many cases, we're so smart that we're almost too smart for our own good. And so really breaking that message down to what just everyday people, and you do such a wonderful job of that, Hugh, which is why we love being on the show as well, is that you just really have a nice way of breaking down to what everybody just understands. And so that's what we try to do is bring that message down just to that everyday American, average American, you know, that isn't as interested in politics as we are and live it 24/7, but they are interested in terms of how their pocketbooks are going to be impacted by bad policies. And look, honestly, the red governors, they all got it. Yeah. I think every single one now, except for maybe two states, but it is in the process, are pulling back that extra extension of the unemployment benefits. That has been horrible on our small businesses. They cannot find workers to work those jobs. And so, you know, we have one small business owner, for example, that owns a restaurant, actually three restaurants in southern Florida, had to close two, open one, and asked his mom to come in to bus tables because they just literally can't find workers.
Now, it is on the East Coast, it's getting close to 7 o'clock. It's 6 o'clock in Tennessee. Of course, it's 4 o'clock in the morning out in California. The people who are in their cars going to work are small business owners because they have to be there first. They have to open the doors. That's they have to get everybody in. They got to do the clock. They got to check the benefits. They take care of their employers. In fact, yesterday the governors were talking about how employees matter to them as much as employers, and that's true. But those people may or may not have joined JCN. They may have the free rider effect, which is in economics. They say, well, I'm glad somebody's doing that.
Right.
But they need to be part, because you've got thousands of people who are part of your roles, but it's got to get bigger and bigger. They really do have, you've got enough jobs to do, but just stop at the computer and go to joinjcn.com and add your voice.
Yeah, we're very proud of the work we've done. It's taken a few years to get to where we are today, but I think we really represent our small business owners the way they need to be represented, not only in the Hill, not only in D.C., but really that's why I'm here, right, talking to the governors about what's impacting them, what we can do better. Every single one of them has talked about the labor shortage as a major issue, which is a major issue for our small business owners. I had another small business owner, for example, in Atlanta, who has a kitchen and bath remodeling business. And she came in, walked me around her business, and I asked her, how is business? She goes, it's fantastic. It's never been better. She goes, but the problem, see all those rows and rows and rows of cabinets? Those are yet to be installed. So I've already paid for all of this, and I have no income coming in.
Yeah. I see you seeing them, and they see you, and they beam. They smile.
Yeah.
And so you've made this connection. You've spent your time well. You're a young guy. You'll be doing this for a long time at joinjcn.com.
Thank you.
But these relationships matter, because then when a state needs to fix something, I love the Idaho governor yesterday saying, if he sees a good idea, he steals it.
Yeah, that's right.
You are the conveyor of good ideas.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is amazing, again, what these governors have done. And sometimes they are so focused on their state that we forget to take that story and translate it on a national level. We have to make America understand that in each one of these states, these models of freedom that we talk about, less red tape, lower taxes, it's working. It works. That's why we see these unemployment rates of 2.5% in all the red states.
Now, do you go out and do speaking?
A little bit.
I think the franchise organizations ought to have you come. For one thing, he looks like a young Kyle Chandler. I was sitting here when you were at the other. Has anyone ever told you that?
No.
No, I looked up and I said, well, that could be Kyle Chandler sitting down there. You could go coach Texas Friday Night Lights. But you're good at this. Thank you for stopping
Thank you.
Got up early. Alfredo Ortiz from Job Creators Network, go to joinjcn.com and come right back. We got the governor parade beginning next hour on The Hugh Hewitt Show.
Oh, Lahore. Oklahoma, where the wind comes sweeping down the plain, and the waving wheat can sure smell sweet.
Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. Governor Kevin Stitt is my guest. He just asked me how many years I've been doing radio. About half your lifetime. I've been doing this for 31 years. And television the same amount of time. So Governor Kevin Stitt is from Oklahoma. He does not have his headphones on, so he did not hear the bump, which was marvelous, Adam. Thank you, back in studio. Governor Stitt, we went to break. You were saying you came home and you told your wife that you were going to run for governor. And she said, let's pray about that a long time. And she did not persuade you not to run. So what happened?
You know, that's right. We had a great life in Tulsa, and everything was going well. She always accuses me of wanting things to be hard, always going for the next challenge. Like, can you not be satisfied? And I think the Lord's wired me a little differently, but I just saw Oklahoma being at the bottom of all these categories, that I knew that we were a better state, and I wanted to show the world how great Oklahoma was, the culture, the people, the family values, the business environment. And so I basically just raised my hand and said, I'm going to run. And I think everything is mental. I was so scared. I didn't know anything about it. I had to Google, when is the governor's race? During the race, I was listening to NPR, and they were like, it's like this guy just woke up one morning and decided to run for governor. And I was like, that's pretty much what happened. Yeah.
Well, your first mistake is listening to NPR. I mean, that's number one. You should not be doing that.
It was an accident.
Oh, yeah.
I see what they were saying about me.
We got the tape now, Governor. We got the tape. So you're like Glenn Youngkin. Glenn just got the nomination in Virginia. And he's a businessman. And I was early backer of Ducey, early backer of Youngkin, because I think governors really benefit from having run a private sector operation, because a lot of politicians get in there and it's executive. It's not legislative. So has it been harder or easier than you expected?
Well, I'll tell you that you're exactly right. Our forefathers, they never thought that politics was going to be a career, an industry. They wanted people to be school teachers and lawyers and business people, and thought they would leave their private sector job, come serve their state or their country, and then go back. And that's the way I've been trying to lead Oklahoma. I've been attracting these very, very successful business people all over the state to come serve with me. The way I do it, I tell them, I say, if you don't come serve for at least 2 years, you can never complain about state government again. And I am literally getting people to walk away from huge CEO jobs to come take a 2-year sabbatical to come serve and run DHS, 6,000 employees. A guy took a couple companies public. I had him come. He's running tourism now, 500 employees. And I told him, go become top 10. I want every bathroom sparkling in our state parks. I want everything pristine. And these are business people. These are big CEO jobs running state government. And that's been my playbook.
Well, yeah, I have visited the state of Hobby Lobby. I've been down to the great state of Hobby Lobby. It is a state.
Oklahoman there.
Yeah, and I met with the Green family. They also have this extraordinary attention to detail, which is, again, private sector driven. And I don't know much about Oklahoma. I've driven through it a few times. I've been to Oklahoma City, to the Green campus, to Hobby Lobby campus. Do you have the inbound migration situation that Governor Lee was talking about? U-Haul's coming into the state from California and Washington State. And are people moving to Oklahoma?
We do. I hear from our real estate community all the time that just say the five showings they had this week were all Californians moving here. My Economic Developer of the Year award that I'm given this year is to my good friend Gavin Newsom of California.
You betcha. Well, okay. He is the favorite. I've been at the RGA for 2 days, and the favorite governor is Gavin.
He keeps winning all these awards.
Yeah, he does.
He's done more for our economic development, our pipeline. But the same thing. I mean, Tennessee, Texas, Oklahoma, these states that believe in freedom, and we've been opened up from the very beginning, and we're not prescriptive on how to live your lives. We believe in personal responsibility. It's really resonating. There's never been a time in America where you can see the difference between a blue-led state versus a red-led state right now. And I just think Americans need to open their eyes to what's happening.
30 seconds to break, Governor. Is this your first RGA, first year of RGAs? Were you elected in 20?
I was elected in 18.
Okay, so you're a four-year veteran of this.
That's right. This is my third year.
Are you up for re-election this year?
22 is when I'm up.
Yeah, that's right. This cycle, anyone running against you?
You know, just a couple of smaller name folks have kind of filed, you know, knock on wood. Our numbers look really good. Oklahomans, I feel like, are really happy with the job we've done.
We'll come back, talk with Governor Stitt about Joe Biden and Team Biden. He's not very popular here at the Republican Governors Association, oddly enough. But we'll talk with Governor Stitt right after the break. Stay tuned, America.
Oh, what a beautiful morning. Oh, what a beautiful
morning. Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt at the Republican Governors Association, talking with Governor Kevin Stitt of Oklahoma. He's been generous with his time. I appreciate it, Governor. Governor, you are a Native American, the Cherokee tribe. And at the same time, I wanted to catch up with you. There are Native Americans everywhere in the United States. A lot of them listen when I'm up in Montana. A lot of listen in California. What happened at the Supreme Court that impacted your state? Tell us about that.
Yeah, so it's called the McGirt decision. So last summer, McGirt was a child rapist, and basically this defense attorney went up to the Supreme Court, got something heard up there that said he should never have been convicted by the state. So he had been in prison for 20 years, and they said the reservations in Oklahoma were never disestablished. Well, in Oklahoma history, we knew that we were former Indian reservation. I'm a fourth generation Oklahoman. And so what has that done? That means that now the tribes are in control or have to prosecute crimes. So the state cannot prosecute crimes. So the district attorneys are telling me it's just thrown up a checkered board of jurisdiction. We're having murderer, rapist being let out of prison. There's 76,000 cases that the felonies are being reversed and turned over. The U.S. attorneys and the tribes don't have the manpower to prosecute all those crimes. So serious criminal justice issues and safety concerns in eastern Oklahoma right now. But the bigger issue, we think we're trying to figure that out. The feds are trying to prosecute as many as they can. The state district attorneys have lost jurisdiction. But the bigger issue now is, what if it bleeds into taxation and regulation? There's thousands of protests right now from eastern Oklahoma at our tax commission of natives saying they don't know income tax. Well, I'm like, listen. I'm an Indian here. I'm a member of the Cherokee Nation. But we have to have one set of rules regardless of your race, because we all go to the same high schools. We all go to public schools. We drive on the same roads. If we get to a situation where 10% of the population has a different set of rules, then the state has lost its sovereignty. We're not a state anymore.
Yeah, I was telling you during the break, when I was a land use lawyer, I've retired now, in California. I've been teaching common law forever. I've never taught Native American sovereignty issues. But I did represent land developers in partnership with the tribes who had put difficult-to-place land uses like landfills onto the reservations that did not have gambling. First question, do the tribes in Oklahoma have casinos?
Yes, they have casinos. They're the only no private sector company is allowed to have casinos. They have an exclusive right to operate casinos.
So they are flush with cash.
Flush with cash.
So everything that comes now, the practice of the California tribes is to take out any opponent of the tribes. If you leave them alone, they leave you alone, Republican and Democrat. And if you are at all a critic of the tribe, out you go. Is that the practice in Oklahoma?
The big casino executives are out to get me. There's no doubt about that. They don't like me. They don't like me opposing them. But Oklahomans appreciate it because I'm standing for what's right for all 4 million Oklahomans, not just one industry. I want everybody to be successful, but not at the expense of a non-native business.
Okay, so given that situation, are you trying to find a way to get back to a new Supreme Court? That was a 5-4 decision. Since then, Justice Barrett has replaced Justice Ginsburg. So that might be a quick flip of a bad precedent.
You know, we think so. We went to Noah Feldman, who's a Harvard law professor,
oh, sure,
constitutional law, and we had him tell us, what did we do wrong in this case? Is there a possibility that we could flip this case over? And he wrote a 40-page memo. It's out there in the public domain that basically said he thinks there's a 60 to 70% chance that it's at least limited to criminal only because of the Sherrill case out of New York that the Supreme Court decided on, or a 50-50 chance that McGirt would be overturned completely. We think they got this wrong because in Oklahoma, we have 2 million Oklahomans, non-native now, living on a reservation. Nowhere in the country do you have 2 million non-natives. What about their rights to be they're under the jurisdiction of a tribe? And
assure you, I have got two justices listening right now. They're regular listeners. And this is about the time they go to work, about 7:30. What did they not know when they made this decision?
You know, Oklahoma disestablished the reservations at statehood. In 1907, you can even go look, the tribal members, the chiefs, have all testified before Congress. Oklahoma was former Indian reservation. I'm a fourth-generation Oklahoman. Tulsa grew up. We are stronger because we didn't have reservations. A reservation is land held in common by the tribe or the federal government for the use of the tribe. In Oklahoma, we allotted out all the land, 160 acres at a time, back in 1907. And they did away with their court systems, and we flourished. And so they're taking us back 100 years in our thinking and really throwing up my abstract, your abstract, all of the jurisdiction in eastern Oklahoma to question, like, if an Indian moves in and buys land next to this building, do they have to follow zoning requirements? All those things, if you're on a reservation, it's different rules. I mean, we have right now cities suing tribes because they're trying to put in, like to your point, and not following zoning. They're trying to put in there's one where they're trying to put in a slaughter facility right now and not following the state's.
Well, if they're a sovereign entity, they can. That's the problem.
Yeah, that's the problem. And so the Supreme Court made a decision that really took half of a modern day state and said, oh, we're going to throw this back 100 years.
So how soon do you anticipate getting up there with or bringing a case that might lead to that?
You know, our attorneys are looking at the right case, and we're hoping to get something back up and run it back the flagpole within the next, two or three months.
All right. Now, Governor, I've been asking each of the governors about federalism. And for a non-lawyer and a business executive, you're awfully familiar with this. Do you believe that Team Biden is eroding federalism at a fundamental level?
Oh, absolutely. The decisions that they make when we call up as the governor, the Trump administration was so welcoming to governors. We would have calls with them all the time. We had direct access to the White House, to all their cabinet secretaries. The governors I've spoken with, as we've tried to reach out and say, here's what's happened in our state, it really falls on deaf ears. They know best. They know best how to run the country. They know how to run our states. They know what's best for the people of Oklahoma. They want a one-size-fits-all. And that's the great thing about America is we've got 50 independent states and independent democracies where we're closer to the people. So we believe that the states, we believe in the 10th Amendment, and the states should make the decisions based on what's best for them.
Now, I played at the beginning of the show the testimony of David Chapman, President Biden's nominee to run alcohol, tobacco, and firearms. And he defined an assault weapon as everything that has a detachable magazine that can fit a 22 or what Tom Cotton called a 5.56. I don't know anything about guns. What do you think of that? Oklahoma is kind of a friendly gun state, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. We're a Second Amendment state. I signed that in 2019. So we have an open carry, and I know it's different in downtown New York City. And that's the thing about federalism. If New York wants to do something different than Oklahoma, that's up to their people to vote in the right leaders. But we're certainly going to push back. I mean, I will defend the right for us to bear arms in the state of Oklahoma. We're going to do that. We're going to push back when we think we need to. As far as our pipelines, we think the safest way to move oil and gas is through pipelines. Oklahoma has more pipelines per capita than any other state, yet we have some of the cleanest water, cleanest air in the country. Actually, eastern Oklahoma town was ranked the cleanest water in America. We've reduced our emissions three times the national average since 2005 because of clean burning natural gas. And so we don't need the federal government telling us how to run Oklahoma, and we'll put our state up against anybody when it comes to.
Governor Ducey was sitting in your chair yesterday and was telling me about Taiwan Semiconductor and his big new plant that he's very happy because he's got the big semiconductor plant. And Doug is not shy about telling people when he's won a big one. Do you negotiate individually with businesses to come to Oklahoma?
You know, I do. Scott Mueller's my Secretary of Commerce and does a fantastic job. But I will absolutely pick up the phone and make phone calls. I sign with our Quick Action Closing Fund, which is a governor's closing fund. And so I have to sign all those letters. Commerce does the analysis, let me know if it's net positive to the taxpayers. But yes, I get involved, and we're a very flat organization. I'm trying to deregulate. I've got an initiative to get rid of 25% of our regulations in the next 4 years. But I'm actively engaged, meeting companies wanting to move to Oklahoma, and we're doing really well.
Now, last question, Governor. A lot of great things have come out of Oklahoma. especially Baker Mayfield. And I'm glad to hear you're a Browns fan. Are you really a Browns? Okay.
Yes, absolutely.
We're going to win the Super Bowl this year. People don't know that. We're going to win the Super
Bowl
this
year. First time that y'all won a playoff game since 94, right?
We did not win in 94. We were in a playoff game in 94, but we did not win. And that was our second playoff game since they came back in 99. So I've had season tickets since 99, and they haven't had a playoff game in Cleveland. This is the year Baker's going to do it. But a lot of good things come out of it. Do your college kids who go away to school come back? The brain drain is what I'm getting at. Do they come back?
You know, that was an issue for us a few years back. They are coming back. The quality of life in Oklahoma right now is amazing. The Oklahoma City Thunder, the things we're doing in Tulsa, downtown Tulsa, it's just amazing. When people come to Oklahoma and they see the quality of life, they fall in love with it. We just have to get out of people's head the mentality that Oklahoma's backwards, that we hear about people thinking that, you know, we're still riding down horses and all that kind of stuff. But when you come to Oklahoma, it's a wonderful town, wonderful state. And when people get there, they absolutely love it.
How is the school system? My one question for all the governors as well is, did the teachers' unions hamper or accelerate your reopening? And are they working with you, and are they a force for the good in your state?
You know, for the most part, teachers are, you know, obviously your unions are a little left-leaning. They were trying to close stuff down just like other states. But in Oklahoma, all of our schools are open for in-person learning. And for the most part, 99% of them were open all year long for in-person learning. There were two school districts that I was just hammering to get open. They finally opened in early March for in-person learning. And but parents are – we got so many education deals across the finish line this year. I got an open transfer. So parents get to choose. Government shouldn't stand in the way of where a parent wants to send their kids to school. I got more investment in private schools.
Are charters welcome there?
We've got charter schools. We went ahead and funded charters more appropriately this year. We got that across the finish line, which is a fight with the unions always.
And tax reductions, you told me during the break, 6% to 4% on corporate.
That's exactly right. I lowered corporate tax, and my plan is to phase corporate tax out over the next 4 years. So we want to have zero corporate income tax and recruit corporate headquarters to the state of Oklahoma. We lowered personal income tax a quarter of a point to 4.75. So when Biden's out there raising corporate rates, raising individual rates, we want the business community to know that Oklahoma is open for business.
So do you think the brand, the Republican brand, which has been discussed a lot in these conversations, ought to be what you're doing?
I think so. I think there's never been a contrast greater than there is right now. We believe in freedoms and personal responsibilities. The government, I'm now the head of the government. We don't have all the answers. These people there in COVID were sticking their finger in the air going, let's reduce it to 100 person. No, let's do 50. No, we're safer doing 30. I'm telling you, in those rooms, I was in the rooms and I was saying, with these bureaucrats that were telling me to shut our state down, and I was saying, absolutely not. And I was on the calls with the Democrat governors, hearing their conversations, and it's ridiculous. We believe in freedom, not Fauciism. That's a quote of my buddy Governor DeSantis. I think Americans are seeing that. They're seeing that right now and just going, you know what? These Democratic policies have got us nowhere.
Freedom is actually, we are a liberty-loving, we are a freedom people. Governor Kevin Stitt, great to have you. I hope you keep coming back. Thank you for dropping by and staying longer this morning. Go Browns and go, I can't say go Sooners. I'm an Ohio State fan, but go far enough.
Go Browns.
Go Browns.
Thanks for
having me. Thank you, Governor.
Here.
I'll be right back, America. Stay tuned. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show. I want to remind you that our sponsor is andrewandtodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home, or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to andrewandtodd.com or call them at 888-888-1172. Morning, Glory, America, bonjour, hi, Canada. Greetings to the 400 affiliates. I am in Nashville. I'm Hugh Hewitt inside a conference room with various governors this morning. Right now, Governor Brian Kemp of Georgia. Good morning, Governor. Thank you for joining me this morning.
Hey, good to be back with you, Hugh. Thank you.
Last time you were on the show with me, I thank you for Nick Chubb, who is doing great things in Cleveland for the Browns. I'm glad about that. But I asked you about the voting law, and it hadn't been passed yet. And you said, well, let's wait and see what's going to happen with it. It passed. You signed it. It's great. But you hear all these conversations about it being discriminatory. What do you say to people about that?
Well, I've told, done, gosh, well over 80 interviews now, just telling people the truth about the bill, which is not what the left, Stacey Abrams, corporate America, or Major League Baseball says it is or thinks it is. It makes it easy to vote and hard to cheat. I've always pushed for secure, accessible, fair elections in Georgia, and that's what it does. I mean, I've answered every single question to every outlet. You hadn't seen the other folks doing that, defending the bill. I mean, every single Republican voted for this bill, Hugh. It was a good bill. People that were in, legislators that were in tough districts that outperformed President Trump voted for it. Legislators in hardcore Trump districts voted for it. We hit the sweet spot with it. I think the Democrats and the left, quite honestly, overplayed their hand on this one, and I'm taking it to them.
Well, yesterday, four banking executives appeared before Senator Scott in a hearing. Here is what Senator Scott asked them.
I know that Senator Toomey had a question about capitalism versus stakeholder capitalism, and I'd add to that woke capitalism that seems to be running amok throughout the financial institutions of our country. It seems like you all are very comfortable picking winners and losers, specifically those who signed the letter in opposition to Georgia. That would be Bank of America, Citi, Wells Fargo, and Goldman Sachs. Picking winners and losers in certain areas, especially in election law. I just want to understand your position on that very important law, because I, as a Southerner and African American who's voted in the South all my life, would hate any form of discrimination, anything that restricts voting rights. What part of the Georgia law restricted voting rights or was discriminatory? Any of the four that signed the letter.
I have to stop. It goes for 8 seconds, but if I go 8 seconds, the radio stations of America will think I've had a stroke. What do you think about that?
What'd they say after the 8 seconds?
Nothing.
Well, that's kind of what everybody's stance has been. I mean, even some of them have come and said, hey, is there just something we can work on to tweak to And I said, look, no, we're not going to do that. We're not giving you cover for overplaying your hand and folding to these people that are extorting you, really. It's corporate blackmail in the name of politics. And, the sad thing about it, Hugh, is people like Stacey Abrams are profiting off of this with all these voter groups she's got taking money off the top and Lord knows where else. And you got small business people and their employees, a lot of them minorities in Atlanta, that are getting screwed by losing the All-Star game. I mean, it's ridiculous. And I tell you, people are just fed up with it. It's gotten people fired up because Georgians know what's in the bill. Georgians know it's easy to vote and hard to cheat. And nothing in this bill is going to keep that from happening in the future. And what's even more ridiculous is you compare it to the states where these companies that Senator Scott just mentioned, or New York, where MLB's headquartered, or where Ken Chenault or Ken Frazier are from, their states are more restricted than ours, and so is President Biden's.
I have never seen politicians sprint as fast as Carl Lewis, as I saw Stacey Abrams and Raphael Warnock run away from the MLB boycott of Georgia.
Even got him to change one of her op-eds. I mean, I've never heard of that happening. Well, could you imagine if that happened to a Republican or a conservative?
No, but I also don't think MLB's coming back. The damage they did is not going away in Atlanta. And the significance of that, people don't really understand unless they're a baseball fan. And I am, and I'm not buying any Indians merch this year because MLB is represented by Rob Manfred, and the Braves spoke up, but nobody else did. Has anyone from Major League Baseball called and apologized?
Oh, no. I don't think they're backing up. I mean, I've spoken to other owners off the record that are not happy with the decision. They didn't even know it was coming. They know what a terrible decision this is. I mean, what are they going to do when the Braves get in the playoffs? I mean, where are they going to take the game next year? I just think you're not going to see them say a word about this and try to let it, kind of blow on by. But I guarantee you people in Georgia aren't going to remember or forget.
I am not going to forget either. Not for a year. Now, I want to talk to you about vaccine passports. We know about the fact that corporate America tried to screw Georgia, and people aren't going to forget. But vaccine passports have been big discussion in the hallways. What's going on in Georgia about those?
Yeah, we just did a executive order just a few days ago that would not allow vaccine passports, as they shouldn't be allowed, in my opinion, with anything to do with state government. So, you know, kids going back to our university system, our public university system, kids going into the K through 12 system, you know, any of those employees, anybody wanting a state government service, whether you're going in to get your driver's license or get help with, you know, issue at Department of Revenue or whatever, you know, permitting at EPD, EPA, or even EPD or Department of Natural Resources or Ag, we're just not going to ask people if they've been vaccinated. I don't think that's the way to handle this. And talking to, you know, a lot of health officials, we didn't do that on mask. I don't think it's right to do it with vaccines. I've been vaccinated. My whole family has. I'm going to encourage people to continue to get vaccinated. I continue to tell people Operation Warp Speed was a medical miracle, and President Trump, quite honestly, hasn't gotten enough credit for that. But I think he will as time goes by, because it is miraculous that we're just a year into this and we have that, you know, that awesome vaccine. But it also is in the trial phase or emergency use authorization. And, you know, there is people that have hesitancy. They're not sure. They've been waiting. And people don't trust the government, Hugh. You know, even though I'm governor, you know, I've been a small business guy for 35 years now. And, you know, I don't want more government in my life. I want less. So I'm encouraging people to talk to their doctor, talk to their local pharmacist, talk to people they trust, whether it's their faith leader, you know, the people that's, you know, in their family that's taking the vaccine, make a decision that's good for them and, for goodness sakes, for their children. You know, I certainly don't think government needs to be mandating at this point, or any, quite honestly, that we're telling kids what kind of shots they need to get. I think their parents and caregivers can make that decision for them.
Now, I've been vaccinated, and I urge everyone to go get vaccinated, but I've also had Dr. Fauci, Dr. Francis Collins on. They said the same thing you just said, the same thing. Talk to your doctors, talk to your pharmacists, go forward with that. I am curious about schools in Georgia, because I'm asking, well, first I got to ask you about federalism, because I've asked every governor, is Team Biden destroying federalism in the United States?
You know, I'm like, I think a lot of my colleagues, I really am surprised at how far President Biden's being drugged to the left. I'm not sure why that is. I don't know if that's just the way he really thinks or that's just the nature of their politics right now and where he is. But I've been really surprised that he has gone so hard. I think it's bad for the country. It doesn't matter whether it's the border, the way they're handling the rescue funds, unemployment, you know, just a lot of other things, the mixed messaging that's coming out of the White House. I mean, I had some conversations the other day with some folks that really believe it's time to open international travel up to countries where it makes sense. And I think we have the ability to do that. We've shown that in Georgia at the Atlanta airport. But you got some, you know, health people in the Biden administration, they're blocking really the will of a lot of other people in his administration that think it's time to do that. You know, the airline industry and those associated with it, I mean, it's tens of thousands of jobs, good paying jobs, great companies all across the country and the world. And they're just holding that back. So I think all of those things, it's just so frustrating when you have mixed messages and, you know, the decisions are made more on politics than science or policy. And I feel like that's where we are. Thankfully, the governors are the incubators of democracy. We've certainly seen that in the pandemic. And I think there's going to be a lot of test cases when you look at how states are doing, you know, whether they're democratically controlled, whether they have a Democratic governor or Republican governor. When you think about economic rebound, you think about the opportunities that you have ahead of you and how tough those headwinds are, or whether you have the wind at your back. Getting kids in school, the gap loss that we've had in education because a lot of these states wouldn't allow kids to go back to schools. And we did that in Georgia. I mean, we've had most of our schools back since last, you know, late July, August, early September. You know, we had a few of the metro systems that didn't go back right away. They have pretty much gotten back in now. Most of them are doing summer programs to help with that gap, and that's going to be a 2 or 3 year process. But thankfully, the governors are really the ones that are pushing this change. I mean, a lot of this stuff wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for Republican governors.
Governor Brian Kemp, thank you for joining me. Keep coming back. I'm so glad that you are letting MLB know and the rest of the country know that Georgia is still leading the way, and I appreciate your being here.
Thanks, you.
Be right back, America.